Have you ever had a burning question about the Bible, theology, or the Christian faith? One you wish you could ask a world-renowned scholar? Now's your chance. On Ask NT Wright Anything, Professor Tom Wright tackles your biggest faith questions, and we want to hear yours. Submit your question today at premierinsight.org/NTW, and you might hear it answered in an upcoming episode. It's that easy. Visit premierinsight.org/NTW now and be part of the conversation.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim White and I'm joined by my dad, John White. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And today we're tackling the concept of the world's falling birth rates. Some people might have heard about this. It's kind of been talked about for a few years now, but there is increasing awareness, isn't there, that birth rates around the world have been tumbling for some time. But I think that what was previously assumed that this is a kind of rich world problem. But what the data is showing actually is that this is now a kind of almost universal experience across the world, with a few geographic exceptions. Countries around the world are seeing people have fewer and fewer kids.
Absolutely. And it's a remarkably global phenomenon, virtually global, and also very resilient. I mean, year after year, we are seeing a trend, a remarkable trend, which I think does have huge implications, but which, particularly in Christian circles, seems to be of hardly registered to any great extent. But what I find fascinating about this is thinking back to my previous era. You know, the world I was brought up in was in the 70s and the 80s. And at that time, the constant drum that was being beaten the whole time was global overpopulation. There was a constant doomsaying about the coming catastrophe.
Mm. Did you know the world might soon reach 6 billion? Terrifying levels. How could we possibly feed them all?
Well, we couldn't feed them all, but then people just extrapolated on a curve. Mm. This, we would be at 8 billion and then 10 billion and then 12 billion. Food supplies would run out, there would be global unrest, conflict, there'd be mass economic degradation, and what are we going to do about it? Mm. And there was an enormous level of concern.
And it was taken for granted, wasn't it, that the most moral, ethical, helpful thing you could do would be to go to these poorer developing nations that had at the time very high birth rates and try and get all the women there to, you know, adopt family planning and contraception. And there was, you know, vast UN sponsored programs traveling around, you know, India and Africa and parts of Asia, trying to kind of get birth rates down. That was kind of seen as like a broad, obvious, good thing to do.
It absolutely was. And in fact, sterilization, forming, you know, surgical sterilizations was being undertaken on a mass scale, often causing
voluntarily political... or
well, it was in theory it was voluntary, but in reality there were often scandals about illicit pressure being used, bribery. You know, if you have your sterilization, the government will give you some special deal, and a huge concern, and therefore the moral thing to do was not to bring children into the world, you know, to forego your rights of fertility. And I remember, you know, even having three children, as we did, was regarded as, you know, pretty irresponsible in this current climate. You know, do you really feel that this is an appropriate response to global situation?
So the global total fertility rate, which is the kind of classic statistical measure that is used to try and track this, which basically is a number which estimates how many children a woman will have in a certain year. A woman would theoretically have over their lifetime in a certain year, if that makes sense. This peaked globally in 1963 at 5.31, or at least in modern times it peaked. And that obviously, that average hides a massive variation within countries. There were some countries that would be up in, you know, 9, 10. Some countries would be lower. But only one country on Earth at that point, little Luxembourg, had a below replacement rate, which is about 2.1. So to account for the fact that some women will die before they have any children, you know, the average couple of one man, one woman needs to have just over two children to kind of keep the population ticking along. So 5.3 it was at in 1963. Do you know what it's at globally in 2023? Would you care to guess?
It's just over two, isn't it? Because it's still going up.
It's 2.25 we're at. So we're just about at replacement rate globally. But that, of course, masks enormous variation today. So the UK, where we are, well, England and Wales, we're down at 1.49. So way, way below replacement rate. And in fact, the only reason the UK population has not already started declining is because of large, high levels of immigration in recent decades. The US is a bit higher, about 1.7, 1.6. But there are a lot of countries that are way below us. The lowest would be a few nations in East Asia. So I think Japan's down at 1.3. And so the lowest in the world is often thought to be South Korea, which in 2023, according to the Georgetown Journal of International Affairs, reached astonishingly 0.72. and is projected to continue to decline. In fact, the South Korea government's aim is to push it back to one by 2030, which, let's note, one is still almost less than half of the actual replacement rate of 2.1. So this is a massive, massive turnaround, isn't it? From just 50, 60 years ago, it was consensus globally that the world was headed to a crisis of overpopulation. Now, fertility rates have plummeted so quickly that we are heading towards a crisis of depopulation.
Yes, and it's just important, I think, you know, to recognise that it's one of the advantages of growing older is it just gives you a sense of perspective, you know. What are the things that we are so utterly obsessed about now that will turn out in 20 to 30 years' time to be completely in the wrong direction?
Sobering
thought. But, you know, the our confident expectations and predictions so often go wrong. But the other thing that I find, well, one of many things that I find fascinating about this is how it seems to be happening in countries that are totally different, have very different histories, different cultures, different attitude to women, and all the rest, and yet a remarkably widespread global phenomenon.
Yeah, that's right. I recently listened to a fascinating podcast about this with a kind of sociologist, anthropologist who's done a lot of research on it. And she was commenting on the same point that, you know something strange is happening if birth rates are falling simultaneously in, you know, hyper industrialized Western capitalist nations like the United States and also in, you know, rural Tamil Nadu in southern India, which again has seen birth rates drop below fertility rates. A drop below replacement rate. And I think a lot of people, again, have this vague sense that this is a correlated in kind of richer nations, you know, like your South Koreas, your Japans, your Americas. But actually, you know, Thailand, fertility rate 1.3, Iran 1.7, Russia 1.5, Mexico 1.8, even Indonesia is only just at 2.1. So this is really a perplexing kind of global phenomenon, not just associated with kind of wealthy, elite, Western industrialized nations where people have kind of lost interest in having families. It's even in some of the same countries, you know, that in your early era as a student, people would be traveling to Bangladesh trying to teach women about family planning. And now Bangladesh has a below replacement rate, fertility rate, and we should be trying to teach them how to have more kids. I mean, it's an astonishing turnaround.
It is. And China, of course, is perhaps the biggest example of that, because the Chinese government was desperately concerned about the population explosion.
Yeah.
And there were massive and coercive effects of forced sterilization, the one child policy, and so on. And then within a generation, a complete turnaround. And now the Chinese government is pleading with its population to have children.
That's right. So China's, I mean, the stats are a bit shaky because of what's going on in China at the time. But in the 1960s, some estimates have been that China's fertility rate was as high as 7.51. And it has now crashed to, it just hit 1.0 in 2023. Which is why, interestingly, China is no longer the world's most populous country. It's been overtaken by India, having held it out for a long time. And the Chinese government have now, in recent years, not just abandoned the one-child policy, but they're now encouraging people to have at least three children, with mixed results, as far as I understand.
It's interesting. This is echoes of what happened in Stalin's Russia, isn't it? With a centralized planned economy where everything is planned from ahead. So, you know, the next 5-year plan is we need carrots and potatoes. And hang on a minute, now we've got the other
vegetables. Too many carrots and potatoes. Yeah, everyone needs to start making steel for the factory. Yeah, it is slightly classic, and it makes you think that's a microcosm of is the story here. Were we too successful in our kind of Malthusian panic about overpopulation in the 20th century? Were we basically too successful and we've now overcorrected and we've changed practice, family planning practices so extensively, we've now pushed people into depopulation?
Yeah, I think that's far too simplistic, I have to say. I think it's a much deeper and interesting set of forces, which let's try and unpick it a bit.
So what are the reasons then, do you think, people?
Well, out of interest, I stuck it into a Google research AI system, put the question, and it spat out a research report with 8 variables. And I have to say, I thought it was rather good. So
you should have just taken responsibility for it, Dad. Yeah, yeah, I know. Strip off the Google AI logo, put your name on it.
Well, that's the way forward, Tim. You know, when I'm no longer up to it, you'll have the AI version.
The AI, yeah.
Yeah.
A much more improved Merlin, I suspect, in those days. So let's have a look at what Google thinks some of the reasons for declining birth rates. I mean, number one, it says increased access and use of contraception and family planning.
Yeah, and it is interesting that the very roots of pro-abortion groups like Mary Stopes and other
Planned Parenthood.
It was all about contraception. The vision was to make available easily accessible, effective contraception. This would allow women to gain control of their fertility.
That's the other side of the thing. There was the Malthusian worry about, you know, we're all going to starve because the world will get too big. But there was a separate strand of concern about birth rates, which was from the kind of early proto-feminist movement in the kind of late 1800s, early 1900s, which was that women are kind of disempowered by having so many children. You know, if you have 8 children in your lifetime, it's impossible for you to pursue education or a career, and you become a kind of chattel of your husband and chained to the home. And so a lot of the early, as you say, a lot of the early pioneers were trying to lower birth rates to in effect deliver a kind of social win for women in inclusion in the workplace and in society.
And there's no doubt that, you know, prior to that, contraception was really not talked about in polite society. It was something just kept completely private, and there was a vast amount of ignorance. And the campaigners, by talking about it, increasing levels of education about fertility and so on, there's no doubt that that has created and made a difference. But I think it's definitely possible to overstate that, the impact of contraceptives, because, you know, the places which have been much less influenced by you know, where fertility rates haven't fallen, particularly sub-Saharan Africa, they've also had access to contraception for 50 years.
And in fact, the AIDS crisis prompted a massive boost in trying to encourage people to use condoms in particular for separately, not to prevent, you know, to prevent the spread of AIDS. And yet, as you say, sub-Saharan Africa has today some of the higher rates of fertility.
So I feel it's just a bit too simplistic to say, you know, you hand out the pills and all of a sudden
people have fewer children. It must play a role, right? Because as we talked about before, the pill was a kind of revolution in terms of, you know, there've been rudimentary forms of barrier contraception for a long time, but the pill in terms of its reliability and the fact that it is gives the woman agency rather than relying on the consent of the man, it must have had some impact.
Yeah, I think that's right. But I suspect the bigger impact is as what has been described as a contraceptive culture, which for the first time raises the possibility that having children is optional. It now becomes a thought experiment, whereas previously not having children is just part of being human. It's part of being, particularly being married. If you're married, you have children. If you don't have children, it's very sad.
Yeah.
But once contraception comes along, you say, oh, hang on a minute. This is now a choice. This is not just part of being human. I've got a choice to make.
And so I guess you're saying the impact of contraception is not so much on the literal fact that it encourages people to have fewer kids, but the way it starts to shape how people think about child rearing and family formation in the first place. And I'm convinced throughout this whole conversation that the most significant drivers will be cultural ones, not policy scientific ones. I think when people choose to have or not have children, I think they are in many cases being those decision is being driven by deep social and cultural factors that they're even not aware of themselves.
Yeah. Well, I know that we'll come back to that. So number two in the list is rising female education and labor force participation.
So this is the idea that as women have more access to education and therefore going into the workforce, they are just frankly not in a position to either want or be able to have children because they're busy working. Whereas in previous eras, post-industrial revolution, you know, there was this kind of clear gender divide. The men went out to work, the women were at home. So what else was there to do but start families?
And this undoubtedly was a big factor in Western countries like the UK, wasn't it? Starting with the First World War, that... The transformation for the prospects for women, improving education, opening of job markets. Then the Second World War, when the women did so much of the work at home that was previously done by men. So women flood into the labor force. They become increasingly equal to men in terms of training and then. How do children work in all this? Suddenly there's a real conflict, isn't there?
And I think even for those women who would like to have it all, as the phrase goes, and be working women and also be mums, there is just a narrower window to do that. Because if you're delaying kind of family formation and childbirth until your mid-30s because you're trying to get stuck into your career and you don't want to take time out when you're at your most fertile, which is, you know, 18 to 22 or something, you were busy at university, then you're building a career, by the time you're ready to have children, you're ready to step out of the rat race, you might already be in your late 30s. And so there's literally the window, the time in which you have available to have large families has been massively shrunk. And so you can only really have one or maybe two children before you're in your 40s, and it becomes increasingly difficult and risky. I think that's massive, massive factor.
I agree. And I think that, I mean, just again, thinking back to my past, the way the cultural attitudes when we were brought up by very loving parents was that the boys should concentrate on getting a career. And yet for the women, it was much less important. Yeah, if they were fascinated by a career, that's fine. But really much more important to find a good mate and build a family.
Yeah.
So now that would be seen as, for many women, are completely inappropriate. You know, my expectations are that I should have the same opportunities as the boys. I should be able to fulfill my academic, professional potential and explore everything that's available.
Yeah. And I see that in, you know, as someone in his 30s in a Western country, I see that very, very much as the default. The cultural norm is that, of course, women aren't thinking about having kids in their 20s because they're busy, you know, doing their master's degrees and starting to work their way up the career ladder and all that stuff. And it just seems the handful of people I know who did decide to kind of step out and have children in their 20s that are kind of looked upon as curious freaks, you know, bizarre. Yeah. It's a bizarre, almost self-defeating decision. Maybe that's not expressed to their faces, yeah, but I think it is broadly seen as this kind of like, what are you doing that now? You're losing out. You're missing out.
Yeah, and then it turns out that actually the women are doing extremely well in their professional roles and often better than the men. And, you know, in business, in academics, in professional life. And so, again, the idea that they have to be the ones who take out the child-rearing.
Yeah.
This is a sort of a trick of biology. Just because I happen to have a womb and not the other bits, you know, why should that interfere with my professional development?
And this obviously spills over into the things we've discussed many times with podcasts, which are the attempts to use technology to kind of circumvent that limitation. So, you know, things like freezing your eggs and various other forms of fertility technology are you could say crudely are an effort for women and men, their partners, to kind of transcend the limitations of biology, that women have to, you know, bear children, or even surrogacy could be a way to try and evade that and kind of really to have it all.
And this is where biology does put a spanner in the works, because there's no doubt at all that from a biological point of view, the safest and healthiest time to have a baby is in your early 20s. And that from the time you get from 25 onwards, your fertility is declining, but also the complications of childbirth are increasing.
Yeah.
And
the risks of health concerns with the children as well.
Everything. So, you know, reproductive technology, the massive growth in reproductive technology is in large part, I think, not entirely, of course, but in large part, it is created by couples delaying their fertility to their 30s and sometimes 40s.
Yeah. Okay, number three, economic development, urbanization, and the cost of child rearing. So this is the idea that since people have noticed that urban populations typically have lower fertility rates than rural ones, and there is therefore wondering that is that because in rural societies, children are seen as an asset. They're, you know, another pair of hands on the farm, whereas in an urban, more industrialized economy, children are just a drain. You know, you can't, no longer, we're not allowed to send them down to the factory anymore. They just sit there at home sponging up money and time and taking you out of the workforce. And so as the world urbanizes, inevitably people tend to have fewer children, or at least that's the theory.
Yes. And there's undoubtedly something in it, isn't it? Because in an urban environment, childcare is blooming expensive. I mean,
yes. out in the villages, going up and up.
Out in the villages, you've got an endless supply of, to caricature it, but you have, haven't you, aunties and uncles and the extended family and grandparents and all the rest. So there's something about this isolated nuclear family, the urban environment, the competition for childcare resources, which just unintended consequences, aren't they?
Yeah. Though I think we should note that, particularly in the West, urbanization, you know, kicked in approaching 250 years ago, and it didn't have an immediate impact on birth rates. And, you know, I mean, famously, the cities were full of slums, weren't they?
That's true.
Teeming masses. With, you know, the kind of Dickensian image we have is of, there are children everywhere. Your Artful Dodger types running feral. In the sewer of London.
You're absolutely right.
So there is. It's clearly. I think you're right. It must play a part of the story, but I think it's a bit more complicated than simply you turn up in the city, having been an agrarian peasant, you become an industrial worker, and suddenly you're like, it makes no sense to have children. Of course, there's going to be a time lag as culture shifts, but I think there's something else. It's a bit too neat.
No, I think it's a very good point, and I think again it points to these sort of deeper cultural and philosophical changes, doesn't it? Mm. And the economic factors, the cost of raising children.
I mean, the other thing to say here is that the modern debate is often characterized, particularly by those on the left of politics, as, well, the reason people are having fewer kids is because it's so expensive. you know, nursery costs and schooling and everything else. And so there is big pushes you often get from kind of progressive parties to, well, the way that we could turn this around is by massively subsidizing the cost of childcare and providing other, you know, better maternity leave and pay, and making it, you know, the idea that people are sitting down doing the sums and saying, it just doesn't financially make sense for me to have children.
Yeah.
And you've seen some nations, particularly in Scandinavia, have invested quite a lot of public money in, you know, giving very generous parental leave policies and free childcare. And what is fascinating is that when people have looked at these policies and tried to assess, do they make any difference to birth rates? The answer is almost entirely no, they don't.
I think Scandinavia, they shifted the needle a bit, but it's very small and it's and very, very expensive for governments. So again, it's interesting, isn't it, that the economic factors clearly in themselves are not the overwhelming thing. I mean, it's something that often frustrates and irritates me when you get these decisions. Do you know how much it costs? You know, it costs £180,000 for every child to raise to 18, you know. And I'm thinking, you mean I've spent £500,000 in my just think of the lifestyle I could have had, the Lamborghini, the international holidays. And but it's such a reductionist and transactional.
Nobody has children because they think it makes them richer.
The investment opportunity.
And so I think the parallel is also, I think very few people don't have children because they fear it will make them poorer. I mean, maybe it's in there. It's a marginal impact. But I am personally unsurprised that much as I might separately support, you know, some government programs to lower the cost of childcare or to try and improve parental leave, I think that those should be done on their own merits, not because we think they might be some kind of silver bullet and suddenly fertility rate will surge back above 2.1. I think the evidence shows it's not going to happen. And I think that doesn't surprise me, because I just don't think people sit down and do a Google spreadsheet, you know, get their Excel out and figure out, you know, it's going to cost me this much over the years and I'm going to make this much. And what is it going to impact on my marginal take home income? I just think people don't do that calculation.
Yeah.
The next one the AI suggests is reduced infant and child mortality. So this is has been actually shown over a long time span by kind of geographers, and demographic data shows that there is a strong correlation with as infant mortality goes down because of, you know, modern medicine, improved sanitation, development in general. Within a generation or so, people start having fewer children, and the kind of hypothesis is that part of the reason people have so many kids historically is because it's a kind of insurance policy, because people expected some of their children to die during childbirth and in childhood. And as that becomes less of a reality, people feel, well, I don't need to have five kids anymore because I think two are going to die. I might just have three or even two.
Yeah. So I'm very interested in this from a pediatric point of view, because again, I think there's a lot of evidence here. And it's quite counterintuitive. So if I go back again to my early days as a student and as a young adult, the basic idea was that, you know, global overpopulation making, you know, terrible catastrophes. So what are you doing sending missionaries and doctors to these countries?
Saving their children's lives.
To save their children's lives. I mean, what planet are you on? And of course, people didn't always say
it quite bleak, isn't it, when you put it like that?
But you could see them sort of saying, you know, is this really the right priority? But interestingly, the evidence showed right from that, from the early days, that there was a definite correlation between improving child survival and lowering population rates. And when you talk to the people, you know, in African villages and so on, there's a very obvious reason why. I mean, the reason you have the most important thing is to have someone who's going to look after you when you're older, someone who's going to do the harvest, someone who's going to. And the reason you have eight children is to have a reasonable chance that one or two of them will survive into old age, because that was the level of child mortality.
And that's the safety net required in underdeveloped countries where there is no old age pension, there is no welfare state, there is no public subsidized healthcare. If you don't want to live as a beggar in your old age when you can't work for yourself, you need to have family members who are willing to kind of share their economic surplus with you, in blunt terms.
Absolutely. And once the expectation begins to rise that my children are going to survive into old age, or just into adulthood, as most of child death occurs, you know, as babies or under the age of five. As that expectation rises, as I see other people's children surviving, as I see my children surviving, suddenly the pressure to carry on having babies declines dramatically.
In fact, this is a well-recognized kind of geographic phenomenon often called the demographic transition, which is that there is actually a bit of a lag. And so the first thing that arrives is, you know, modern medicine and improved sanitation and healthcare, and infant mortality drops. And this leads to a sudden spike in birth rates and in population growth, because suddenly, you know, people are having eight kids, but three of them aren't dying anymore. So suddenly the fertility rate paradoxically goes up. And then after about a generation, that cultural understanding trickles through and it now starts to plummet. And that's what we saw in Western Europe 200 years ago. And then we start to see the same thing in the 20th century in the developing world. And so there's a kind of theory that people started to panic because they saw surging populations and spiking birth rates. But actually, if you could just hold on, it was inevitable that would soon start to come down. And a lot of the kind of 20th century worries about overpopulation were just because we were living in the spike and hadn't yet kind of ridden out the curve and saw as we're now seeing population numbers start to fall. Well, they're not falling yet, but they will soon start to fall if we don't turn around birth rate.
That's right. And so on a big picture, if you see the global fertility curve, you see this rise, and then as child survival improves, you see it plateau off. And now it's starting to fall, and that is that this delayed phenomenon of people's expectations changing, and them changing their behaviour in accordance, and that's again why probably that's part of the explanation why the places on the planet where the greatest rate of rise is still there are the poorest countries in sub-Saharan Africa, where child mortality is still incredibly high and where, therefore, traditional family sizes are still maintained.
Yeah. And it's difficult, this, isn't it? Because as you alluded to in that, you know, talking about being a paediatrician, this is an unambiguous success for humanity, right? That we've, for the first time since human beings, you know, started gathering in societies tens of thousands of years ago, we have cracked some basic problems that caused, for time immemorial, horrible numbers of children to die in childhood.
Yeah, absolutely. You know,
that we don't give children water contaminated with feces and other things. And, you know, when they have minor infections, we have these things called antibiotics to cure them. And you're like, this is a wonderful, wonderful outworking of human ingenuity using the good creation that God has made to make life better for everyone. And so it's really bittersweet that in some sense it's this idea of reducing infant mortality, which you'd like to believe everyone is on board with fewer children dying, has actually become a bit of a kind of totem pole of anxiety about overpopulation.
Well, it is interesting, and you're absolutely right. And it's something which often strikes me, you know, if you read anything into history, right in the Victorian era and beyond, massive child mortality was just completely normal. Every single family, every household would watch babies and children die. And the idea, you know, we're almost the first generation where child mortality tragically still occurs, but it's such a rarity that it seems inconceivable.
I mean, more children probably die from kind of accidents and things these days than from preventable diseases.
They do, sadly, and things like suicide. And so it's, well, certainly adolescence. Yeah, so I think these are extraordinary changes. And from a Christian point of view, you know, we give thanks for it. And a lot of it is because of Christian understanding of science and medicine and the natural order and using our God-given intelligence to
And potentially also a Christian understanding of the intrinsic value of every child. You know, a lot of cultures see children as an irritant or as kind of subhuman, not yet full equal citizens. And yet the church has from day one held, following the example of Jesus in the Gospels, held children with almost an especial regard and not treated them as detritus, disposable, but said every child is precious. You know, famously, the early church would go around collecting children that had been abandoned by their secular kind of pagan parents and left to die of exposure, and would raise them as their own. You know, potentially that, a long, long way down the line, kind of bled over into efforts by kind of Christendom era doctors to say, well, maybe we should figure out why children keep dying from these diseases.
No, that's absolutely right. And interestingly, pediatric medicine wasn't a thing in ancient Roman Greece, because children weren't important. The only children who mattered were the children of emperors and, you know, who might carry on the bloodline. But apart from that, children were simply of no account. Whereas, as you say, the Christian faith brought, you know, the significance of babies into and children, and that's remained ever since. And it's so much part of our modern world, isn't it? A pro-child,
yeah.
You know, it's such a part of the baked in, and yet actually, it's something that isn't by no means obvious.
No, absolutely not.
Have you ever found yourself in a conversation about faith and struggled to find the right words? Maybe you've been challenged by tough questions and felt unprepared to respond. That's why our Confident Christianity course was created. It's an interactive online course designed to help you understand and share your faith with clarity and conviction. You'll gain the knowledge and skills to engage in meaningful conversations and confidently defend what you believe. Right now, you can get access to this powerful course as a special thank you for your gift to Premier Insight today. Your generosity helps bring resources like this to more people seeking truth. Get access today and start equipping yourself for those important moments. Just visit premierinsight.org/confident. That's premierinsight.org/confident.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Okay, finally then, we come to shifting social and cultural norms. This is the idea that the real underlying cause, or one of the underlying causes of declining in birth rates is not, you know, medical, biological, demographic, but is fundamentally about how people think and feel about families, about marriage, about individualism, about gender roles.
Absolutely right. And I think this is where... you know, philosophy and the power of ideas, this is even greater than all these other factors. And I think a lot of it I would put to the Enlightenment and the rise of individualism.
Though we should note quite a long time lag then historically, given that we didn't see birth rates start to fall for almost 200 years after the Enlightenment.
And that's the fascinating thing, I think, about the history of ideas. And that's why I see them like an acid, you know, that this acid starts and it starts eating away at a massive superstructure. And it's actually taken 200 years of those acids of individualism to suddenly the superstructure just starts collapsing. Because all that underpinning, all that... there's a phrase, the social imaginary, which I think Charles Taylor invented, but it's a kind of what can be thought, it's not an overt, you know, most people are not the slightest bit interested in the history of ideas or interested in philosophy, but nonetheless, those acids are there, changing attitudes.
And potentially part of what reason, if to use your analogy, the acid of individualism took so long to eat away is because for the first 150 years, it was kind of counteracted by the institutions and structures of, well, in the West, at least, Christianity. I mean, would we say that the church was a kind of buttress against individualism or against the idea of having small families and focusing on your personal fulfillment as opposed to your kind of obligations to your community. And it's only as that with the explosion of secularism in the post-war second half of the 20th century that the Enlightenment individualism can really get to work.
I'm sure that's part of it, and the influence of the church. But I think about politics and the understanding of a nation and the nation state. Mm. I mean, one of the things that's astonished me when I was reading about the Second World War was the way, for instance, in the RAF, young men, 18, 19, 20, every night would climb into their flying machines, knowing that there was a very good chance that they would be killed. And yet they just kept coming. The numbers who deserted, the numbers who refused to obey orders was minuscule. And they were doing it, why? Out of a sense of duty. This is what you do. You die for your country. You sacrifice your future. You sacrifice your dreams.
You leave behind your wife and children.
You do the right thing. Why am I doing it? I'm doing it for my country. I'm doing it for my family. I'm doing it for, you know, for others. And we look at this now and imagine if, you know, World War was to break out and 18 to 20 year olds were being asked.
See, I actually disagree with you on this one, Dad, because I think we have a great counterexample, which is Ukraine, you know. A very modern, developed country. I don't know off the top of my head, but probably had a lower birth rate than we did in 2022.
Yeah,
and yet an existential national crisis occurred and millions of Ukrainians volunteered to go and abandon their careers and their families in Kyiv and go and train with a Kalashnikov for 3 weeks and then go and try and fight off a Russian tank.
They did.
And that's waning now. And I appreciate that there have been rising levels of desertions and they're having to use conscription a bit more now. But I think, I personally think there is something about war in particular which focuses minds and cuts through the atomization of society. And I don't personally doubt that if there was a Second World War type crisis to hit the UK, that the Gen Zers, I think they would rise to the task.
Well, hang on a minute, because it was also true. I think millions fled Ukraine in the first weeks. I mean, there was a massive flow out. And in the same way, there were millions across the country, across the world of Ukrainians, and how many went back to fight for their country? A few, but not millions. So I think the interesting thing about Ukraine is, yes, it shows that patriotic fervor and the willingness to die for your country is still possible, but I think it became an incredibly divisive phenomenon. And large numbers of people said, you've got to be joking. And I think that's what would happen. And I think the exodus to New Zealand or to, you know, go anywhere on the planet where I had to escape from the draft, even if my country is under existential threat. So anyway, I mean, pray God it never happens. And we don't see the experiment being, but of course it might. Hmm. And so I think individualism is such a powerful idea. In the end, I owe it to myself. It is me and my values and my thinking and my future.
Yeah.
That's a very powerful asset.
And I think in particular, it's not just individualism, but this idea of expressive individualism, the idea that the most important thing for me is to kind of actualize my potential and to become the best I can be. And that I owe it, as you say, I owe it to myself to pursue a career and education, to develop my values. You know, when you talk to people across the West about how they kind of sum up their inchoate values, well, often it's about, you know, well, I want to develop my values. I want to be true to myself. I want to be authentic and genuine. And it's all coming from me outwards. And you can see that the idea, particularly for women, that raising children is an intrinsically other-centered thing. You lay down your desires, particularly as you have to, you know, raise the child within your own body for 9 months, destroy your own, you know, ability to sleep and be throwing up all the time, and then go through labor and then breastfeed. Like, you are putting everything outside. You are not self-actualizing. You are not realizing your potential. You are putting all of yourself into this child that can't even say thank you for 10 years.
No, absolutely right. And I was just reflecting that, you know, this individualism in its roots is a very European and in many ways a Christian heresy. I mean, it comes from the Reformation understanding of the uniqueness of every human being made in God's image.
Yeah. And taken a little bit too far, perhaps.
Just taken a little but I think what's so fascinating is that this particular acid is working in Confucian China and in
Hindu India
and across the world, whatever culture and religious setting it comes into context, it has this ability to eat away.
And that's what I think. This came up in the podcast, which I'll leave a link to in the show notes, this idea that part of the reason this decline in birth rates has accelerated and become such a global phenomenon is because the ideas and the philosophy of Western individualism is being transmitted at the speed of fiber optic cables through the power of the internet and the smartphone and social media to cultures as diverse as, you know, rural Mongolia and Seoul in South Korea and, you know, an island in the Caribbean and sub-Saharan South Africa and all this. It's because we're all, for the first time in human history, connected into the internet, a single medium of exchange. And yes, of course, the internet varies wildly. But if you're on TikTok, if you're on Facebook, if you're WhatsApping with people transnationally, you are, our cultures are bleeding into each other. And to use analogy, the acid is leaching out of Europe and spreading around the world at the speed of light.
It absolutely is. And the Gen Z culture is definitely not a pronatal culture, is it? I mean, you know, just think of everything that young people are being exposed to on TikTok. It isn't celebrating the wonders of family rearing and childbirth. You know, I'm sure they are around there, but it's not the dominant vision, isn't it? The dominant vision as being pushed by influencers and by gurus and is again an individualistic. It is so,
or at least if you have children, it's the idea of this like ultra intensive parenting in which the child becomes a kind of avatar for your hopes and dreams, and you're going to spend unconscionable sums of money on everything from, you know, a sleep coach when they're young to extra tutoring to special technology and all this stuff. And the idea of having another child or even a third or a fourth child is just insane, because who could possibly keep up with this kind of over the top parenting for multiple children?
Only to discover that when they're 15, they go, push off. I never asked to be here. Yeah. Go away.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think that certainly people point to that idea in particularly in kind of East Asian societies like Japan and Korea, which have seen some of the lowest birth rates, is it's now so normalized. Something like 95%+ of South Korean teenagers have like compulsory coaching and tutoring after school, sometimes as late as 10 p.m. And that's just not just for like rich elite middle class families sending their kids to private school. This is just across the board, and it's so draining and so expensive, and you're constantly ferrying your child to their special violin lessons and their tennis coach classes, and also they're learning how to code and they're also learning Mandarin, that parents are just exhausted financially and emotionally, and they just cannot countenance the idea of having, you know, 2.1 children to keep the population ticking over.
Okay, so let's fast forward to implications. We've looked at a whole lot of different mechanisms, and but you know, what is this doing to our world, a graying world? Again, Google came out with a few implications, and one was population aging and potential stagnation or decline,
which we've discussed on this podcast before, haven't we? About the kind of the growing number of elderly people and the consequences that is going to have on the kind of declining tax base and the rise in the need for carers and problems around things like dementia. So, yeah, as you need a kind of healthy, flourishing society needs a certain proportion of working age people for every elderly person. You know, you need more working age people to pay effectively for the chronically unwell older person who lives now almost to 100 years old. And yet we actually have the opposite problem. We have fewer numbers of healthy working age people as a proportion.
That's right. And another unforeseen consequence, though, is the rise of grey power, isn't it?
the pension of vote.
A pension of vote. Politicians around the world are discovering that the baby boomers are a growing force to be reckoned with, you know, and that they vote, they write to their MPs, their activists, and they insist on being looked after number one. That's
right. Despite decrying the idea of handouts, they actually subsist on pensions, the ultimate handout. But anyway, yeah, let's not get all class warfare on this one. But yeah, no, you're right. I think it's really already has reshaped a lot of democratic politics in the West, this idea that politicians have to really, really pay heed to the ever-growing numbers. And because they... you know, this is not their fault, but they vote at much higher rates than young people do. They have a disproportionate influence. And so from the, you know, from our UK context, you can see both left and right parties, Labour and Conservatives, are totally committed to this idea, what's called the triple lock, which is the kind of policy which keeps the state pension outpacing inflation, outpacing earnings growth, outpacing GDP growth. And every year the pension goes up and up and up, and it's becoming harder and harder to afford. I think it was initially well-intentioned because the pension had actually been slightly declining in value, but it's now pensioners have the most wealth of any cohort in the country. And yet no party, not the new Labour government with enormous majority in parliament, doesn't dare touch the state pension.
No, that's right. And I agree. It's totally unjust, but nonetheless, it is the power of the grey vote. So shrinking labour forces, potential economic slowdown. I mean, this again, I think is a real concern.
Yeah,
for particularly for Europe, is it the greying of Europe, isn't it? Mm. That the industrial power base is now
absolutely defined. And if it what again, like we mentioned at the start, if it wasn't for high levels of migration, I think a lot of countries would be facing this even more starkly. You know, in places in the UK, for example, you know, in some of the more dynamic cities, something like London, I think half the population of London was born overseas. And if we hadn't had large numbers of healthy, able-bodied, working-age people choosing of their own volition to come and set up new lives here and start businesses and pay taxes, we would be in an even worse state than we are. But it comes with the flip side of, is this right causing kind of rising social tension? You know, immigration is a massive, massive political culture war flashpoint now. And so it's almost paradoxically, we need it economically because of the declining birth rates. And yet it's becoming more and more difficult to ensure kind of social cohesion and harmony with very high levels of migration and a stuttering economy.
Yeah. And shift in geopolitical power dynamics. I think that's, again, we probably haven't time to go into that in any detail, but it is fascinating that China in particular has a window of opportunity. At the moment, China is still in a very strong position because it has a very large population, which is funding its economic development and technological development. But there is a crash coming because of the low birth rate. And some people have predicted that that means that China's geopolitical dominance may actually be time limited. But I just want to flag up before we come to just talk about from a Christian perspective, I do think there's another big element in this which has been overlooked so far, and that is the techno-optimists will say that the solution to this is basically AI and robotics. That, yes...
As it always is. As it is. It's every problem.
You've noticed, it's the solution to every problem. Well spotted, Tim. So, you know, what is the answer? We're not got enough labourers in our factories. We've not got enough. But lo and behold, China in particular is going all in on robotics. And they already, you know, we look at a car manufacturing plant. It used to consist of thousands of workers, human beings. It now consists of a handful of workers and thousands of robots, industrial robots. And that process could well happen across swathes of industry. And far from it being the disaster that says they're taking all our jobs, what it might mean is that the economy can still continue to grow with shrinking numbers of human beings.
And indeed, some people see this as a win. You know, you have small numbers of elite human beings living off the fat of the land, enjoying this enormous economic bounty produced by the uncomplaining surf robots. What's not to love? Why would we want to share this bounty with a huge population when we could just be this kind of plutocrats living at the top of society?
Yeah, cue science fiction. And of course, that is a frequent science fiction plot of the future of humanity. And it is extraordinary the way that in many ways science fiction is coming true.
Okay, so to come into land then, I think, is it fair to say you and I both agree that underpopulation, that declining in birth rates is a problem? This is not something we should be kind of neutral about. We think it will have serious negative consequences for the well-being of our societies and our world.
Absolutely, I do. And particular in terms of social cohesion. I mean, I think that this individualism is itself, you know, part of this acid is constantly pulling apart social cohesion. But if we have a kind of imbalance between the number of the elderly and the number of the young, that you can see the sort of intergenerational, the opportunities for intergenerational conflict, I think are very real and damaging.
Yeah. Eat the rich will become eat the old. And so if we think this is a problem, what is fascinating to me is how what was once quite a kind of right-wing coded concern, you know, maybe 10 years ago, the only people talking about birth rates were kind of weird quasi-fascist nationalist right-wing types. You know, you had people like Viktor Orban in Hungary, you know, offering bonuses like he's Adolf Hitler to people who have large families, and it's all kind of icky and weirdly fascistic. And you have all you have on the kind of techno side, you know, people like Elon Musk talking about how, well, we need to grow the population so we can go and colonize Mars. And I'm doing my bit by having my 13 children with four different women. But it's a kind of elitist right wing concern. And yet it feels to me like actually it's starting in the last few years to trickle down to more kind of centrist minded people or even left wingers. To say, actually, this is not just kind of hyperventilating social conservatives worried about it. Actually, depopulation, declining birth rates should be alarming to everyone.
I think that's right. But I think the thinkers and academics are actually rabbits in the headlight because they can see the sort of things that we can see. And that is the ineffectiveness of political and economic policies. Yeah. And
the levers the governments are pulling don't seem to do very much.
And if it really is at root about philosophy, about individualism, self atomism of society, and you know, this is the fruit of what we've been arguing for, you know, autonomy and individual choice. This is at the root of our liberal society. And so it does make you think that, you know, any kind of philosophy or society which basically encourages suicide is not going to survive. You know, suicide cults don't tend to perpetuate. And is there a sense in which secular Western liberalism...
It's a multi-generational kind of death cult that's gradually withering on the vine under the force of its own ideas. I mean, it's a provocative question. We probably haven't got time to go into it in huge depth, but I think it's a fascinating question to reflect on. But certainly from a Christian perspective, that idea has become, I think, in certain more conservative circles, kind of taken for granted. You know, if you think about people like your Rod Dreher's, your Steve Bannon's, I think there is a sense in which absolutely they believe that kind of Western secular woke liberalism is a death cult that Christianity needs to break out of, and like all faithful Christians will not just be, you know, following the Ten Commandments and reading the Bible, but they'll also be by default having large families. That's becoming I think, quite established in certain conservative circles, and maybe will start to bleed over. I mean, will we see the kind of all Christians become pro-natalists in time?
Yes, and we ought to draw things to a close. But I think what I'd like to focus on is this idea that really we've talked about this before with relation to things like abortion. But I think you could say that infertility is another example of people not choosing to have children. I don't mean infertility. I mean people choosing not to reproduce is another example of deaths of despair. That you only have children if you genuinely believe in your heart that it's a world worth bringing children into. And again, I have memories back in the 1980s when we were dominated by the Cold War, and the general received wisdom was that nuclear holocaust was very likely. And then what on earth are you doing bringing children into a world of a nuclear holocaust? And of course, the answer to that was what a world of nuclear holocaust will need is it will need people. It'll need people of hope to rebuild the world.
And the contemporary version of that would probably be climate crisis. You know, it's not uncommon in certain trendy urban liberal circles to find people saying, well, I couldn't have children because, you know, the world, the second half of the 21st century is going to be hellish, you know, or because the more children means more consumption, more carbon is burnt, and that's unconscionable. You know, we need to reduce the population so that we have take less of a toll on our planet and can start to undo climate change.
And so isn't it wonderful, and wouldn't it be wonderful if the Christian group above all were seen as the people of hope? You know, the people who continue to have children because they have hope, because they believe in a good God and they trust a good God. They're not naive, they're not closing their minds to the problems, but ultimately they believe in the God who says, don't be afraid.
Yeah, God who says, choose life, not death. And that has been a consistent theme, I think, throughout scripture. You can see it in the Old Testament, the biblical commands to be fruitful and multiply, and that runs over into Jesus's interactions with children. Despite being a single man, he's incredibly pro-family, and the early church was incredibly pro-family, pro-children, as we talked about.
But it's what we're having a culture of despair, really, that paradoxically, isn't it, although individualism tells itself I can be anything I like, I can live the dream, I have boundless possibilities, paradoxically, it goes along with a sense that it's all futile in the end, it's all hopeless. What's the point of bringing new mouths into the world?
I think there's elements of that. I think we need to be careful, though, because what I struggle with, the idea that, you know, everything that came along with Western secular individualism and liberalism was a disaster, because, you know, the counter argument to what we're saying, you know, people in Bangladesh and Chile and China have been infected by the acid of Western liberalism, and that's why they're choosing not to have kids. But the counter argument is, you know, women in these intensely patriarchal, oppressive societies have been captured by the vision of their full dignity and equality as women, sure, which is coming from a Christendom feminist context in the West, and they look around and they say, I'd love to have kids, but not just with anyone. I don't want to lose everything I've gained by going to university and starting a career by marrying some boorish local man who hasn't been captured by that same vision. And I'd love to have kids with someone who treats me as an equal and who will share the child rearing with me once the children are born, and who will take time out of their career to help raise families. And they look around, they don't find those men, and so they don't start the relationships that would lead to children. So you could argue that it's not that we need to junk everything that we've learned, but we actually need to push the accelerator further and say more people in these societies, particularly men, need to have their attitudes shaped and changed, so that they are, you know, catching up with where their female counterparts are already on.
Yeah, you could argue that. I don't think. I mean, certainly, no one is saying let's get back to the good old days where women were around the kitchen sink. Well, some people are, but I don't think either of us are.
We're not saying that.
Not at all. But the answer is not more individualism. The answer goes back to what we were talking about before, which is a culture which is prepared to sacrifice its own interests for the good of others. So it's women sacrificing their own interests in order to have children. It's men sacrificing their own interests, their own selfish interests.
Their desire to be unencumbered, to be, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, to share in the child carrying. So the vision, but ultimately that is the Christian gospel, isn't it? That is a vision of family life structured by Christian thinking.
What does Paul say? You know, submit to one another out of reverence for Christ.
Absolutely.
And his teaching, while controversial to some today, is in its context in that first century Greco-Roman world, is astonishing in saying that husbands have actual obligations to their wives, as much as wives have obligations to their husbands, and to their children as well.
Absolutely right. And so, and of course, that's what the early Christian church was founded on. You know, it took that understanding of the family very seriously. And so it's the Christian paradox, is that in giving to the other, you receive. It's as we give to our children, as we sacrifice our own interests. So that is fundamentally different from individualism. Individualism always focus ultimately on me. It's atomistic. That's, or at least that's enlightenment individualism. That's, you know, that's what comes out, and that's individual autonomy. A Christian understanding of the self is that we discover ourselves in serving others. It's the, as we give, we receive. It's a paradox, a deep but wonderful Christian paradox.
And we're made in the image of a creative and fruitful God. You know, the Trinity was so full of love, it overflowed into creation, including creating people and human beings made in the image of that triune, overflowing, creative God should also not be dead ends, but should overflow in creativity and fruitfulness. And that doesn't explicitly only be expressed through children. I hope not. I've never biologically reproduced and don't intend to. But it expressed, I think, every Christian should, whether single or married, should be focusing on being fruitful.
And you
can be in different ways.
And as a parent, though, as an adopted child, you have discovered, as we all do, this paradox, isn't it? That in the giving and the serving is a wonderful richness.
You become more truly yourself.
Yeah.
Ironically, for the expressive individualist, I become more the person I was meant to be the more I give to the others.
That's right. Which is an astonishing and wonderful paradox about what it really means to be human.
So what we're saying is we should all join the Quiverful movement, and all Christians should be having 7 to 12 children.
Well, get on with it, Tim.
Get on with it, yeah. What are you waiting for? Time may have elapsed for you, Dad, but maybe not for me. All right, let's draw it to a close there before we go down a dark
path.
Moving rapidly on. Thanks, everyone, for listening. I hope you found the conversation interesting. We'd love to know your own thoughts on this question of birth rates and fertility, and in particular, how can the church respond to this? How can we model a different way of being people of hope, while not maybe losing some of the benefits of our Western individualistic age? So do get in touch with us. You can email molad@premier.org.uk. You can also find out lots more interesting resources to stimulate your own thinking at Dad's website. That's johnwyatt.com. You can find some of my journalism, including how you can sign up for my weekly church news newsletter at my website, tswyatt.com. And we'd also be really interested in your suggestions for other things to talk about. Have you seen interesting trends, news stories, scientific developments, cultural shifts that you think we need to dig into on matters of life and death? If so, please get in touch. Again, email molad@premier.org.uk. That's all for now. We'll be back next week with another episode, but until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ12 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.